Well, the first thing I want to say is, mandate my ass. Because it seems as though we've been convinced that 26% of the registered voters, not even 26% of the American people, but 26% of the registered voters form a mandate or a landslide. 21% voted for Skippy and 3-4% voted.
Welcome to a special pre-election program, Voting, Why Bother? I'm Ron Anisich. Every 4 or 5 years, Canadians, like their counterparts in most of the allegedly free world, go through what many see as a depressing ritual, namely elections. Many of us find ourselves in the absurd position of being asked to choose a lesser evil. Many of us feel shamed by our media, government, and peers into casting a ballot as a necessary function of living in a so-called democratic society. But increasingly, people are resisting making this choice. In an era marked by election fraud, political parties that misrepresent the true desires of the people, and blatant cruelty and dishonesty from previously elected governments, one can hardly blame voters who fail to make an appearance on election day. It seems as though the real issue in today's elections is not health care, education, or the environment, but whether or not to vote at all, and it's an understandable dilemma. Increasingly, large numbers of registered voters and even larger numbers of potential voters are fed up with the process altogether. In North America, more than half of us are non-voters. Sadly, much of the reluctance to vote is a result of apathy. This voter apathy often plays into the hands of the very politicians who create it in the first place. Governments are given so-called mandates by increasingly smaller percentages of the people. A head of state can be elected by a tiny minority of the population. This is one of the inherent flaws of our antiquated first-past-the-post system of electing leaders. The reality is that in the upcoming Canadian federal election, it is likely that more registered voters will choose to abstain from voting than will cast a ballot in favor of any of the parties seeking election. And this doesn't take into consideration those who don't even bother to register. In this program, we'll look at both sides of the debate through a series of interviews that I conducted throughout the month of June with people in both Canada and the United States who take a principled stand against voting, people who are working to encourage people to vote, and people who advocate for reforms with an eye towards making the process more democratic. But we'll begin this program by having a look at why people vote, or why they don't, as is the case with Yahya Abdul Rahman, who is the editor of Montreal Muslim News, and who recently wrote a column about why he will not vote in the June 28th election.
From now until June 28th, Canadians will be bombarded with a variety of what I call grandiose promises and disaster scenarios of what will happen if we don't vote for a particular party or candidate. And all these people will introduce a set of promises that have been introduced in almost every election campaign, including jobs and health care, education, environmental protection, tax cuts, etc. And after every single election, these promises are broken by the winners. And they continue on with their original agenda, which I feel is protecting the interests of power and privilege and systematically ripping off the Canadian people. And I feel that all these promises, as I stated in an op-ed I wrote recently, are merely smoke screens which delude us or Canadians into thinking that the promiser, i.e. the people who are campaigning, is the best person for the job and that they have our best interests at heart. And I think that the Canadian people are beginning to see this, and as you listen to the comments from people on talk radio and on the television, etc., people are pretty much fed up with politicians and all their promises that they make and all the promises that they break. And I, for one, will not be voting on June 28th, and I feel that all this talk of so-called democratic choice in the upcoming election is hogwash, to say the least, and the democracy, in my opinion, is much deeper than choosing a political candidate, but it is indeed about grassroots participation in the social and political evolution of our country. The people who are really hold the power in this country, i.e. corporate elites and other elites, are not elected by anyone, and they're not answerable to anyone, and they do not have the interests of the people at heart. Their goal is only one thing, the pursuit of profits, and to hell with the annoying issues such as human rights and environmental protection and the erosion of our civil liberties, these kinds of things. So the people who are really in power, nobody, votes them in, and they don't give a damn about anything that the people say. And these special interests are the interests who the elected officials are really beholden to, and not to the Canadian population. But they will refer to their electoral victory and say, see, I was mandated to do this. I was mandated to do tax cuts. I was mandated to do that, right? But in many times, they're not mandated to do that at all. They put words in the mouths of the electorate. So I would say that, like I said before, these people are there to work against our interests many times, to restrict our civil liberties, to steal more of our hard-earned money to ensure that the rich get richer and the poor remain in their impoverished condition. And I ask the question, what sane, rational person would want to support such a system?
Carl Wattner, who produces the newsletter The Voluntarist and who is co-editor of Dissenting Electorate, an anthology of non-voting, explains why he never votes.
I look upon the government or the state organization, the political organization, as a inherently invasive and criminal and coercive institution. So given that insight or that attitude that I have towards the government, to me, the government is violating all the common standards of morality and decency. When the government collects a tax, it's saying it's threatening you if you're either pay the tax or they'll put you in jail or they'll seize your property. And that to me is stealing. And I don't want to sanction a coercive organization or the coercive actions that the government takes in order to exist.
Chuck Munson, also known as Chucko, is the founder and webmaster of Infoshop.org, a popular anarchist website. Here, he explains his rationale for not voting.
Well, I think that voting is, it's really kind of just, you know, voting the same people into power all the time, the people who have power. You know, it's not, you're not getting your average Joe and Jane in there in the office. It's a system that's disempowering. It takes power away from people. It doesn't really give you a lot of input into local decisions and decisions affecting your life. There's a lot of anarchist sayings about it, such as, whoever you vote for, the government wins, or if voting changed anything, it would be made illegal. So there's a lot, I think there's a lot of solid objections to voting. In fact, you know, over 50% of Americans don't vote in the national elections every 4 years.
Carolyn Baker is a professor at New Mexico State University. She recently wrote an article for Counterpunch explaining why she will not be voting in the upcoming U.S. presidential elections.
Given the 2000 election fiasco here in the United States, the corruption of which has been brilliantly reported and documented by BBC reporter Greg Palast, and given the plethora of scandals in and lawsuits against the electronic voting machine industry here in the U.S., I've decided that clean presidential elections in the U.S. no longer exist. The 2000 election and the corrupt electronic voting system are two of the red flags for me that indicate that we no longer live in a democracy. And I do believe that within the last 30 years or so, the electoral political process in the U.S. has been subsumed by corporations and corporate money, so that no one who is not in bed with the corporations and that whole corporate political system in the U.S. can get nominated, let alone elected. So for me, it's much bigger than let's vote for the lesser of two evils. I guess I'm looking at a much larger picture.
Paul Shore is the Montreal-based national director of Apathy is Boring, an initiative to encourage participation among the potential youth vote.
Look at the government in Canada compared to 90% of the other governments around the world, and it's pretty cozy here in Canada. And the government treats us well, even though we have all these scandals. Comparatively, the government treats us pretty well. So people are negative and apathetic and disengaged. You know, we agree with a lot of the reasons people don't vote, but it's still not clear to people why they should vote. And so we're using those reasons why we don't vote to illustrate to people, well, now's a good reason to vote. In fact, your vote does count. Every time you vote, money goes to the party you're voting for. Now, that person you vote for might not get in because your riding is dominated by Liberals or the Bloc Québécois or whoever, but your vote does count. The party you vote for will get money. Voting is probably not one of the most active ways of participating in a democracy, mm-hmm. But it is a way that everyone is entitled to. And I think it's not a bad first step for young people who are not just disengaged, but know nothing about where everyone stands or even perhaps who's even running. It's an easy introduction. It's not such a huge thing to go vote. And I think that most people who have never voted and are thinking now, well, maybe I'll vote because it's time for me to participate in the democracy and it's time for me to, you know, make sure that my voices are heard, then the voting process, however passive it might appear, is not a bad first step. You know, we're not going to be making radical changes overnight, but I think it's a good first step. And if you're of the mindset that, you know, the option of picking the lesser of evils is really not a very good option, well, look a little closer, because there are other political parties on the spectrum besides the four that we hear about every day.
Michael Parenti is a well-known lecturer and author. His most recent book is The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. While being aware of the many reasons that people might choose not to vote, he's also in favor of voting and points to the perils of dropping out of the system completely.
I believe that voting is heavily refracted by the money power and the media power and all of these things, but it still should not be dismissed outright as being completely meaningless. Imagine if there were no elections. Imagine if the people in power did not have to worry about their image or their policies or give certain explanations, even though the explanations are usually mendacious and misleading. That voting is still that thin sliver that keeps us on this side of dictatorship with one foot in democracy still. So I don't dismiss voting out of hand as a completely misleading and meaningless act. It's an important political act. In a way, the vote's about the only thing the poor man has. We have other things, I tell people, which is agitation, resistance, demonstration, refusal to cooperate on different things, organized actions of various kinds. But the rulers of this country, the people of wealth and station and privilege, not for a moment do they treat voting as something light. They give it enormously serious attention, and they expend enormous amounts of money and expertise evidence on how to control it, contain it, manipulate it, filter it out, and make leaders unaccountable to voters. But they're always looking and focusing on voters, if only to mislead them. It's an ancient question in political struggle: to what extent do you involve yourself in these most imperfect institutions, rigged as they are, rigged to get certain effects? Can you involve yourself in those institutions to get different outcomes sometimes? And you do, you know, I mean, we have elected people who have passed laws that have represented real democratic victories for us. But to what extent is it really just a charade, and what your involvement does is inadvertently add legitimacy to a system that does not deserve legitimacy? I mean, it's not an easily answered question. I do believe, though, first, you see, the fact that the system is rigged, the fact that it's money-driven, the fact that the leading parties are often deceptive and beholden to the bourgeois larger property interests and moneyed interests and such, all that being true, coming to those correct insights, the fact that often the campaigns are meaningless and built around puffery and around secondary or false issues, all that being true, some people then incorrectly conclude that therefore voting doesn't matter and it doesn't matter who gets elected. That's not true. There's a big difference. If we could have had the Progressive Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives, if instead of having 70 members to it, if they had 280 members and could be passing laws, and the same in the Senate, and control the White House too, it would make a difference. There would be different kinds of laws. We wouldn't have the fair trade rip-offs that we have now. We wouldn't be fighting this horrible oil-driven war in Iraq and the like. there are differences, and the people in other countries feel those differences. So it does matter who gets elected, and as long as it does matter, then the question of voting cannot be dismissed out of hand as being just a legitimating charade.
Naomi Rankin is running for a seat in the House of Commons. She is the Communist Party of Canada candidate for the riding of Edmonton-Beaumont. Like Paul Shore, she advocates voting as a first step towards greater political involvement and control of the government and its institutions.
The Communist Party is in favor of socialism. That means we think the working class should be the ruling class. There's a lot implied by that. That means not just that people go and mark their ballot once every 4 years, but they actually have to be involved in running their workplace, running the economy, running the government. When you're a part of the ruling class, you have to actually, you know, participate in these kinds of things. So we're actually calling on people to be much more deeply involved in the political process on an ongoing basis.
There are any number of reasons why people might choose not to vote, but by far the culprit most referred to is voter apathy. And while this is undoubtedly a factor, it is most certainly not the only one. Steve Mulberger, a history professor at Nipissing University, discusses some of the other reasons.
One of the things that should be said is that the American system is perhaps the oldest fashioned electoral system in the entire world. Since it was early on introduced, it hasn't been changed much. It is very old-fashioned, you know, and Canada's is pretty old-fashioned, too, with the first-past-the-post system. Hardly anybody uses that anymore in the entire world. The first-past-the-post system may have something to do with the drop-off in participation in recent years. I suspect that a lot of people who are in their 20s in Canada today have never been faced with a big political issue where their vote meant anything to them, with the exception of people voting in 1995 in Quebec.
Right.
About separation, or whatever it was they were supposedly voting about at that point. What else has there been? I think the issues have not been clear, and all sorts of reasons why your vote doesn't count could be adduced, but it's hard to find in many cases reasons why your vote would count in the last three federal elections.
June McDonald is the co-chair of the Toronto chapter of Fair Vote Canada, an organization which advocates proportional representation. Like Steve Mulberger, she believes that the electoral system itself may be the reason for low voter turnout.
But it's actually the worst system that we could have. It's the most dysfunctional system. As applied in Canada, we're the most dysfunctional democracy in the world. In terms of how people, their intentions for their votes, and what we actually end up with. The fact of the matter is, the majority of us, most of the time, do not elect the governments that we get. For example, 55% of us did not vote for Mike Harris, or did not want Mike Harris.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority did not vote for Mike Harris. As the popular mythology is, he got a majority. Therefore, you people who voted for him, you're responsible for whatever happened. But the fact of the matter is, the majority of people did not vote for Mike Harris, and the majority of people never voted for Jean Chrétien. In fact, Jean Chrétien, in his first mandate, I think he got 37%. People deep down sense that their votes are not counting. The people who are adherents of proportional representation think that the cause is that we don't have a fair voting system, and people sense their votes are not counting, and so less and less are turning out to vote. And of the eligible voters, not the registered voters, but of the eligible voters, only 54%. And then a small proportion of them elect the government. So it's pretty abysmal. Henry Milner, a political scientist from McGill, wrote an interesting book called Civic Literacy, and he notes that the civic literacy, meaning knowledge of your civic process and government and all that and how it works, is very low in Canada and the United States, whereas in a lot of European countries it's quite high. You know, people read a lot of newspapers. They discuss a lot of politics. They're very interested in what's going on. And it may be a cultural thing, but it may be a factor of our voting system. It may be. We don't know. The voting system is not a panacea. It reflects the culture. But it could indicate that people are disengaged because their votes are not counting, and that if they knew their votes counted, they may be more interested in the the political process and what's happening. They may feel more ownership of it. Again, it's a cultural thing, so we don't quite know how that's going to shake out. I personally believe that Kenny isn't all that apathetic. They care, but, you know, why would you care if your vote doesn't count?
So we can see that even those in favor of reform, who we can safely assume would encourage people to vote, see some serious problems with the electoral process. On the other hand, Paul Shore is quick to point the finger at apathy, particularly among young potential voters.
We're speaking to a young generation that is not just disengaged in the political process, but that's straight out apathetic. They don't like being told what to do. They don't respond to rah-rah, get out and vote advertising. So we've taken a different approach to why we should vote and use some, I guess you'd call it negative psychology. There, you know, you can't start fixing the system if you're totally disengaged by the system.
But does it really all come down to apathy? In this next segment, Yahya Abdul-Rahman, Carl Wattner, Chuck Munson, Naomi Rankin, and Michael Parenti take a closer look.
Many people equate not voting, first of all, with political apathy, and this could be further from the truth. There are literally tens of thousands of people in this country who will not be voting in the upcoming election, but they are indeed very politically active, and they're working within various political groups, anti-war groups, anti-racist groups, faith-based groups, etc., and they're very much concerned about the direction in which this country is headed, but yet they have chosen not to participate in the traditional electoral system because they're fed up. People are completely fed up, and they're cynical, and they're getting tired of being lied to and being misrepresented or whatever. And they're working through grassroots organizations, which they feel, and I feel also, that they're much more democratic and representative of the diversity of this country.
I would distinguish between people who are truly apathetic and choose not to vote because of that apathy, and those who take a principled stand and refuse to vote because they consider voting violates their moral principles. Now, that's the class that I would place myself in. You know, how many people are actually in that class is very difficult for me to gauge. I would assume that it's a small percentage of those who actually or generally don't vote.
I suspect that if that weren't the case, that there would be rioting in the streets.
Or at least the politicians would be beside themselves because they would be feeling like their sanction or their legitimacy was lost.
I think that the people who don't vote, there's a lot of different reasons for that. There, of course, there's the reason of apathy, but that doesn't explain all of the people who don't vote. I don't know what the figures are for apathy, but I mean, there's a lot of people who just don't pay attention to the political process. It's not important to their lives. They really have other interests. Then there are people who don't vote on principle, such as me. There'll probably be people who are just fed up with the system. They feel alienated by the politicians. They complain about Washington, or they've, you know, got tired of the Republican or Democratic parties being the same, or they're just frustrated with the lack of alternatives. And then there's probably a small group of people who just feel that whatever's going to happen is going to happen. They're just not going to bother to vote.
It's not an accident that people feel disengaged from the political process because they're hard-pressed to find a party that really represents their interests that they feel has any chance of being elected or forming a government.
It's not just apathy. Of course, there may be some individuals in the U.S. and Canada who just have no interest in politics and they're just whatever, happy-go-luckies, apolitical and not interested. But most of the people who don't vote or who are described as apathetic are really often driven by a sense of futility or disillusionment or powerlessness. And the surveys we have show that they'll often give as a reason, they'll say, oh, I don't care. But, you know, a lot of people say, I don't care about a lot of things, and they do care, and they're just very upset and all. And apathy is often just a psychological defense against powerlessness. It's really not apathy, it's antipathy. It's anger, disillusionment, a feeling that my vote won't be effective, my voice isn't effective, that the choice I have is rather meaningless, that it doesn't matter who I vote for, my plight, my problems aren't getting any better. So what you have is low turnout among the very people who should be mobilizing to vote. Low income, marginalized people, single women, ethnic minorities that are the target of discrimination, such. The groups I've just mentioned, they all tend toward lower voter turnout. And the affluent, well-situated, they go out and vote. They vote because, you know, they know. They know it's wonderful to have a have a George Bush in power or Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor. They know it's going to mean good things for them. It's going to mean this continual battle of rolling back throughout North America and throughout the world, rolling in Europe too, rolling back all the democratic, political, economic, public service, social justice gains that were won during the 20th century, rolling it all back and getting us back to 1900, a country where there was no effective trade union movement, where public education was limited, there was no advanced education that was publicly funded, no environmental protections, no minimum wages, no child labor laws, no consumer protections. That's the kind of society that the reactionaries are gunning for.
Chuck Munson and Carl Wattner prefer methods other than voting to push for political change.
If you take some time out of your day to go vote, you're saying that this sort of system is legitimate. This is the legitimate way to change things and run people's lives. And anarchists have always asked people to take direct action in their lives, which is, instead of asking the government to do something, work together with other people, your family, your neighbors, your friends, to change things or set up alternative institutions. And that's kind of like the vision of anarchism long term, is for people to have the power, the grassroots, a true participatory democracy.
Are there non-political or non-coercive ways of changing society without resorting to politics? Yes. I guess I could say any peaceful, non-governmental approach which a person might choose would fill that or satisfy that criteria. I mean, it can be anything from parents choosing to homeschool their children because they believe that they can raise their children better than they can by sending them to government schools, people engaging in private charitable work, people engaging in business activities, creating new businesses, providing jobs. I think we could include street protests, letter writing, certainly writing books, teaching. I mean, there's just a whole slew of things that people can engage in. I mean, certainly you're choosing to broadcast these radio interviews is a way of trying to influence people, opening them up to new ideas.
Assuming that one has taken a position on whether or not voting has meaning, another question is raised. Is our current system of government beyond reform? Can it be repaired? Or are we, as Chuck Munson and Carl Wattner suggest, past the point where this is a realistic expectation?
Well, I think here in the United States, I think the system of government is way beyond reform at this point, and you can see that in the rhetoric that's popping up in the campaign. There's people talking about asking John Kerry to pick John McCain as his running mate, sort of like unity and heal the country and bring the country together. That shows you how desperate they are right now. A lot of people are upset at the government, at both parties, about the war, about the economy, a lot of other issues. I mean, anarchists is always going to argue that we should get rid of the government. I think the United States government's kind of proven itself to be kind of a bad character on the world stage, especially the last couple of years. But it's not just George Bush is the problem. It's to be John Kerry. He could manage a nicer war that still ends up killing people and diverting resources that could be used for schools and health care in the United States. But I just don't see reforms as an option in the United States right now.
I don't believe that government can be reformed to eliminate its coercive nature. I mean, we might make it a little more palatable, or maybe it'll steal a little bit less here, or fine-tune it a little bit. But if government, as it existed historically, and as it continues to exist today, I don't believe it can be reformed to change its inherent nature, because if government can't collect its taxes under the threat of violence, people are just going to ignore it, and we wouldn't have a government then. We would have voluntary institutions providing services that people want.
Carolyn Baker and Naomi Rankin think differently about the possibility of progressive reform.
I don't feel that our current government is beyond reform, and this is the point I really wanted to get across to people who call me defeatist, and that is that reform will not happen, I really believe will not happen, by electing the right president. Since a candidate who would make the changes needed cannot get nominated, let alone elected, how can voting for a president make a difference? In fact, playing the voting game, and it is a game, thanks to the corporate political system and Diebold, the largest manufacturer of electronic voting mm-hmm. machines, playing that game only perpetuates, in my opinion, the illusion that we live in a democracy and that we have authentic choices. I'm not sure if reform prior to a worsening of events is really possible at this point. The 2000 election proved that we no longer have clean elections in the United States. We also have the USA Patriot Act here, which is now mm-hmm. law in the U.S., which has shredded our Constitution and our civil liberties. We are an empire hell-bent on economic, military, and political domination of the world. And those horrific realities are not going to be changed by pushing rigged voting machine buttons for the lesser of two evils. I also believe that if there is to be reform, revision, purification, transformation of the U.S. government, it's going to have to come from the grassroots efforts of individuals and communities who demand accountability, starting locally with their elected leaders in their communities.
There's room for improvement, let's say, but the really profound reforms that we're interested in would be nationalization of major corporations and putting working people in charge. So that involves not just a matter of, you know, scraping up a majority of seats in Parliament, but a really aroused and involved working class that's going to participate in those kinds of activities on an ongoing basis. So we run in elections. That's not the only thing we do, right? Because what the really important work is building up those coalitions of democratic movements that could, you know, can possibly take power in the long term. That's the sort of work that happens when elections, when you're not actually running a formal election campaign. There's certainly room for improvement in Canada of making the formal electoral process more democratic. But to make the society really more democratic, we need really profound social and economic changes, and a change in the balance of power between the classes in society.
Among those who believe the system can be saved or changed to be made more democratic, there have been many ideas about how this might be achieved. We'll take a closer look at a couple of them next. As a response to low voter turnout, many countries have enacted legislation to make voting a compulsory act. Belgium, Greece, Luxembourg, Brazil, Ecuador, Argentina, Venezuela, Mexico, Australia, and others all have laws which require its citizens to vote under threat of a legal penalty. In this next segment, Yahya Abdul-Rahman, Paul Shore, Carl Wattner, Naomi Rankin, Carolyn Baker, Chuck Munson, and Michael Parenti share their views on mandatory voting.
I have a right not to vote. I mean, some people say that, okay, well, you give up your right to complain if you don't vote. And I respond to that by saying, no, my right to complain is a human right, and nobody can take away my human rights. I don't think that that is any kind of solution to the problem. I think the illusion is that we have real choice in this country when it comes to election time, and forcing people to vote is not going to solve any problems at all.
I think it's a great tactic. If people are forced to vote, I think that they're more inclined to go out and like educate themselves about what the people who are running, you know, for the leadership of this country stand for. Or if they're so disengaged and disillusioned, but they don't want to pay their fine, they can go boil their ballot. You know, that is a political statement. We're trying to like take a little bit more of a constructive approach. We have a political system here that has problems. You can either reject it entirely and be angry, or you can engage in it and personally put pressure on politicians, personally write letters. It's not to say that things are going to happen to change overnight, but, you know, there's two approaches. The people who encourage people not to vote, that is their political statement. They don't want to have anything to do with the political process, and they're not really contributing to a constructive society.
I would oppose compulsion applied to voters just as I would oppose compulsion applied in any area of life. It's my belief that governments require legitimacy. In other words, governments have to cloak their action in an aura of moral legitimacy in order to sustain their power. And it's almost a demonstration that governments which choose to enact compulsory voting laws are sort of straining their limit in achieving that legitimacy, because they're showing that they have to threaten people with force in order to make them go to the polls and express that support of government. So I guess I would be a civil disobedient if there was a mandatory voting law in effect, because I would consider that a violation of my personal integrity to force me to vote.
I don't know that that's going to be much more democratic than the system we've got now. Unless people have the option of voting none of the above, from our point of view, that's heading in the opposite direction in terms of the concept of how you would solve this problem. What we're interested in is seeing mass organizations like the union movement, the women's movement, the environmentalists, the farmers, the students, immigrant organizations, you know, all kinds of popular democratic organizations joining together and developing an alternate program of their own, of what they want the government to do. You know, a democratic and, we hope, a socialist program. And when people have done that, when there really is an alternate program in place that people adhere to and subscribe to, there wouldn't be no problem getting them to vote for it. Developing a program for government that's worth voting for, it seems to me, is the way to solve the problem of getting people to vote, rather than simply herding them to the polls with the same dreary choices that they have now, mm-hmm. between dumb and dumber, right?
Well, I just have to ask the question again. Mandatory voting for whom? If somebody made me go to the polls right now, if I legally was bound to go to the polls, I would probably vote for some alternative candidate. And, you know, that might satisfy my country, but it wouldn't satisfy me because I haven't voted for a viable candidate. I haven't voted for a candidate who has any chance of winning.
That kind of ties into what people argue about their response to the 50% that don't vote here in the United States. They come up with ideas like mandatory voting or having voting occur on weekends, extending the voting hours, allowing the voting over the Internet. What they don't understand, what none of us understands, is that people don't vote for reasons that are pretty solid. They're not just apathetic. Voting in the United States is pretty easy, but people aren't voting because they don't like the system. They don't like the politicians. They just don't feel connected with the system. They're hostile to the system, and that's why they don't vote. Making voting mandatory or making it easier is not going to change that situation. How can you mandate voting in so-called democracy? Democracy means you freely participate in decision-making, not that you're forced to participate in decision-making. That's fascism.
Yeah, I think a mandatory voting, if that's what it takes, if that does increase lower income turnout, that might be a plus. But there's so many other things that need to be done. We need better ballot access in the U.S. We need elections which are not so money-driven, with campaign controls. We need a limit on the time, the campaign timing. It's the better part of a year the campaign keeps going on. Presidential years, it does. We need to get rid of the laws that favor the two-party monopoly and make it very difficult for third parties to appear on the ballot. We need proportional representation instead of this single-member winner-take-all districts, which rigged the whole system and caused a wasting of a lot of votes. With proportional representation, every vote is counted. If only 15% of the people vote for a particular party, they get at least 15% of the legislature represented, whereas now they get zero, usually, if it's a minority party. And their votes aren't even counted. And winner take all, the same thing. We need to get rid of the Electoral College, which has a distorting effect on the presidential elections. We Americans don't ever vote for a president. We vote for a slate of electors who are pledged to give the rigged electoral votes of that state to president. And all those small conservative states throughout the Midwest, those states are, they all have an extra two votes. That's part of the whole electoral system, which represent the two senators that they have. So the conservatives have all sorts of built-in advantages here, and any serious reformers have a hard time even getting some minimal visibility because of these kinds of things. We need media that allocates large chunks of its time to all the candidates, not just to the two richest candidates who buy most of the airtime. The media really, I mean, the airwaves are the property of the people of this country. The airwaves in Canada are the property of the Canadian people. They're licensed out to these private media conglomerates that treat it as their personal property. And these are the kind of things that need to be changed to make for a more viable democracy.
In the segment we just listened to, you heard Michael Parenti refer to proportional representation. We've already heard several of the interviewees criticize the first-past-the-post system currently in use in Canada and the U.S. and almost nowhere else in the world. In this segment, we'll hear June McDonald, Naomi Rankin, and Steve Mulberger discuss the benefits of a system of proportional representation.
I don't think you'd get this regional disparity in the same way that you'd see the West all one party and the East all one party. You'd see the popular vote reflected in the seats. And actually, we really don't know how it would work out because people are voting strategically now, so you can't really take what we're seeing now and translate that into actual seats, because when people know they can vote sincerely rather than strategically, they may shift more dramatically than we think.
So people might, for example, vote for a Green Party candidate or any other minor party if they had more confidence that those people would actually get a seat.
Yeah, that's the theory.
There's a sort of a mechanism that seems to come into play, really, in a lot of elections where the newspapers and TV and the pollsters and so on, you know, they come up with this description of what they expect the voters to do. And they typically make it look as if it's more to the right than what actually happens on voting day. That has two effects. One thing is it spooks the liberals, it pushes them even further right in terms of their propaganda and their campaigning and their promises, but it also spooks the more progressive people who are so horrified at the prospect of Harper and his gang getting in that a lot of them will be frightened into voting liberal, which is every bit as much a capitalist party, even though they'd really much rather vote NDP or even communist if they were expressing their own views and their own aspirations.
There are several ways of doing it. The traditional way in Europe is they take large geographic areas and they have multi-members in them. So you might have an area that would be comprised of what we have now as 15 ridings, would be maybe 15 people, and everybody has a list. And when you go into the ballot, you marking your ballot, you'll have a list of several names on that, different parties, and you choose the party, and then in choosing the party, you just choose the party's list of names. Some people have open lists and closed lists. Some have completely open lists where you write in the names of people. Others, the list is drawn up by the party. But we don't think that large multi-member districts will work well here. Some people are in favor of the system they have in Germany, New Zealand, Scotland, and Wales, where you keep your riding, but you also vote off a list as well for the party. My stepdaughter, who lives in New Zealand, and she goes to vote, she has two votes. One for the local person in her riding, which is the constituency vote, and one is for the party. And in New Zealand, it's more or less equally divided. They have half the members of parliament come from the ridings and half of them come from the list. And they take off the list to compensate for the disproportionality that comes from the ridings.
I think that a lot of people's complaints about the electoral system, the kind that are expressed, of the sort that we've been talking about, is that nobody stands for what I want, would be addressed by that. And it is the fact that almost every country in the world uses some kind of system that allows for more electoral choice than people have in Canadian parliamentary elections. We've got the old-fashioned thing that worked real well in 1820 or something. In the world, the total world of electoral behavior, this is not satisfactory for hardly anybody. And people in Canada complain about it quite frequently. Mm-hmm. That they would like something else. It isn't right that a party that got 30 or 40% of the vote should be reduced to 2 seats in the House of Commons. And there's been plenty of NDP voters over the years who have felt that, you know, I live in the wrong place. There's not a chance that my guy's ever going to get in there. And, you know, they feel underrepresented, and by one way of calculating, they are. I mean, this is what other people say. The solutions to this particular dissatisfaction are not new. They're 100 years old, and they just haven't been picked up in Canada.
And it depends how it's structured, but you have to have a certain number of list seats. At least a third of the seats should be list seats in order to get a reasonable proportionality. 50-50 is good because then, you know, you get almost complete compensation and you get almost pure proportionality. We probably won't get that because we got a lot of constitutional complexities. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, PEI is guaranteed 4 seats with a very small population. But that's part of the grandfather clause in the Constitution. There's other constitutional issues around Quebec as well. So, I mean, our system is not going to be pure or anything like that. But, you know, we could have a quite a good proportional system, even with all the complexities of our constitution and our environment. You know, we have issues with large ridings, large geographical areas, dense urban areas. The urban people, 70% of them take polls. They don't know the name of their MP, the member of parliament. They vote based on the party, not on the member of parliament. Where in rural areas here, they care more about who the person is that is actually in that riding. And they know the name of their representative. So there's a lot of differences that have to be looked at when you're designing a system. Doesn't mean to say any of this is not insurmountable. If, you know, we have a will, and we will benefit a lot by changing. It's not just political representation, but, you know, non-political representation, representation of women, representation of visible minorities, Aboriginals, will really benefit by changing as well.
Abysmal and undemocratic. That's how some of our interviewees describe the electoral system which exists in Canada and the U.S. today. Just how did our electoral system get as bad as it is? It's important for us to realize that the history of who possesses the right to vote has not been one of a steady enlargement of the group of franchise holders, as one might expect. In both countries, the history of who holds the franchise has been adjusted by the government to protect landowners, maintain white ethnic purity and male supremacy, and even to rig elections, as the Borden government did in the First World War. Steve Mulberger talks us through some of the historical intricacies of who got the right to vote and who was denied it at various points throughout North American history.
It's a very long-standing English attitude towards the electoral franchise is that it represents property holders, people of substantial wealth and a fixed interest in the community. The conservative argument, I mean generic conservative argument over a very long time has been that people who have property in an area have a real interest in that area, and our elections have been very locally based through most of their history in the English system. So maybe there's some truth to that. You know, certainly people who have a lot of money have a very high voter turnout rate compared to people who are broke. You can think of a number of reasons for that, but part of it is that people with money and people with property feel they have a lot to lose and feel they may make a difference, while people who are poor and people who are transient may feel that they don't. Particularly areas with Asian immigration, there was an attempt to keep those Asians from having the same rights to vote as other immigrants. There was a big movement in British Columbia, for instance, to make sure, to keep the country white, basically, by keeping non-whites, as they calculated them, keep them as much out of the political system as they could manage. In an area where the British prejudices weren't the sort of the natural law of the land, whatever the laws actually said. In other words, in Quebec, when there were elections introduced into Quebec, women who qualified on whatever franchise was available at the time were allowed to vote for a while. But there was in the 1830s a move to more clearly define the electorate for the right kind of people. And this applies to the United States as well. And women were specifically banned. And in fact, you know, people in the United States in various areas, blacks were specifically banned at a time when otherwise they might have been qualified to vote. There was a very definite, strong feeling for universal male suffrage in the pre-Civil War period, the pre-Confederation period up here. Mm-hmm. In that period, when a lot of people were being given the vote on the basis that they were adult men, as opposed to property owners of a certain level, then you had to say, well, if people don't have to have property to vote, what is the right restriction? And the right restriction, both in Quebec and in Ohio or Tennessee, was, well, women are not going to be allowed to vote. It's going to be white men. And you can, I don't believe that applied to central Canada, but it did at a later time apply to other parts of Canada. That, you know, when you widen out the franchise in one dimension, you have to say, well, what are the implications? The introduction of a wide franchise for women is very interesting because it was part of the Borden government's attempt to fix the election in 1917, well, a successful attempt. It was a matter of conscription was the big issue. The government felt that conscription was absolutely necessary to support the war effort, but that they might lose, so not just seats in Quebec, but seats in other areas as well. There was very strong feeling against it. So they gave the vote to an awful lot of people who wouldn't have it otherwise, and they took it away from other people to make sure that post-conscription policies were followed. So people who were who had the vote, who were considered enemy aliens, like Italians or Ukrainians, had the vote taken away from them, while women who were military nurses in France were given the vote. And also widows and wives of serving soldiers were given the vote because the government was pretty sure they would vote for the Conservatives.
But it didn't stop there. The Canadian government recently attempted to maintain excessive control over the elections process with changes to the Elections Act. The new rules attempted to silence all but the largest political parties. Naomi Rankin explains some of the changes and how the Communist Party of Canada fought back through the courts.
You could call it almost the last act of the Mulroney government, that they passed changes in the Elections Act, which were really very draconian and had the effect of attempting to destroy smaller parties. Because if you didn't have at least 50 candidates in the election, not only would you lose your official registration so that the name of the party wouldn't appear on the ballot, we couldn't issue receipts, you know, tax receipts for donations to the party like all the others, but they actually included that the party's assets would be seized by the government. And, you know, ours were. Well, we developed a court case. We took them to court. This went to the Supreme Court just a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. They gave their judgment. And we won this at every level of the courts, like starting in Ontario, where it was first brought, you know, going up through the various appeals. So many of the worst aspects of those changes in the Elections Act were overturned. They were ruled to be unconstitutional. And they had a year to make the changes in the Act, which the outgoing Liberal government just, you know, finished passing the required changes in compliance with the Supreme Court about 3 days before the election was called. Well, you could understand that the parties that have a majority of seats, that somehow or another, the argument that large parties ought to have unfair advantages doesn't seem quite so unfair to them. It's just the same way that capitalists can always seem to be able to find good arguments for why, you know, an exploitative system like capitalism is a good idea. It's in their own interest, and it's very hard for them to have the breadth of vision and the objectivity to see that it's not democratic.
The assets that were seized at the time,
mm-hmm.
have you gotten them back?
Oh, no, we haven't gotten them back yet. But that's still to come. I mean, they still have to possibly go squabble with them some more.
If we do vote, how responsible are we as individuals for the actions of the governments which we elect? Are the voters responsible when our governments provide military support to illegitimate governments in Afghanistan or Haiti or worse? How much responsibility do the voters have? Is voting just a passive form of democratic participation, or could it, in fact, be interpreted as an act of violence? Carl Wattner and Chuck Munson can both see how this might be argued.
When a voter goes in the voting booth and either votes electronically or writes in a name on a paper ballot or pulls a voting lever down, that act in itself is not coercive, is not violent. But when we look at the chain of responsibility, when we look at the organization of the political system, we have to recognize that there is a link between the act of voting, obviously the election and selection of people to hold the governmental office, and the fact that those in governmental office then pass laws and statutes, use the army and the police to enforce the political statutes. Now, my argument is that just as the Nuremberg judgments after World War II held the leaders of the Axis forces liable and held people who claimed that they were just, quote, obeying orders, liable for their actions during World War II, that the voters, people who vote, have a liability because they are, one, participating in the system. You might say that they're aiding and abetting the system, that they're acting as accessories to government compulsion, to the crimes that governments commit. So, in effect, voting, while it's not a direct act of violence, is a presumptive act of violence, because each voter assumes the right to appoint a political guardian over other human beings. Each person, by voting, sanctions the violence used by agents of the state.
That's been argued by anarchists for a long time. That goes back to legitimizing the system, legitimizing the government. When you participate in voting, you are saying that this system is legitimate. Some people have facetiously responded to the quip, if you didn't vote, you don't have a right to complain, with the quip, you voted, it's your fault. If you vote and you're participating in the system and you're legitimizing the system, you are basically saying what the system is doing has your consent for the most part. I mean, if you're voting in the system and your country, your government is invading Iraq or invading Afghanistan or killing people on death row or whatever policy, it's a violent system. You're endorsing the violent system by voting. I think that's an interesting argument. I think it's kind of valid.
So if you are still among those trying to decide whether or not to vote, it's worth taking the time to think about what you're going to do. Is it worth voting as a protest to prevent right-wing politicians from gaining power? Are you prepared to accept responsibility for your choice? Are you willing to legitimize a corrupt government and their violent actions? And most importantly, why bother? Thanks to everyone who agreed to be interviewed for this program. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich.